mornings. I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, Mission Possible, the local Christian outreach organization, has a great deal of experience working with the people of Haiti. They will join us to offer a human perspective that often gets lost in the political rhetoric. Also this morning, the USDA recently updated national nutrition standards to help put even healthier meals on school menus. Now, health and nutrition advocates are decrying efforts in Congress to weaken those standards. And the newly formed Great Lakes Guardianship Services Board is taking shape. It is an agency dedicated to helping adults with special circumstances navigate the legal system. We'll learn more. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, September 17th, 2024. 31% of Americans, this is a new survey that I thought this was kind of interesting. 31% of Americans say their entire day is ruined if their coffee isn't right first thing in the morning. Your entire day is wiped out if the coffee isn't right in the morning. It's a poll of 2,000 adults. 52% of coffee drinkers say they enjoy creamers, sweeteners, flavors in their coffee. 52%. 42% like caramel. 33% enjoy white chocolate mocha. Some of the other popular flavors: cookie dough, pumpkin spice, peppermint mocha. My wife is a big peppermint mocha. But one third of Americans, their whole day is ruined if the coffee isn't right. And one in five, so 20%, say that fresh coffee is better than sex. That's what they say. I am not a coffee drinker, so personally, I don't get it. But that's what they say. Neil Sanford of the Chobani Company, they make those flavors, coffee creamers and flavors, that kind of thing. It's a seasonal and indulgent dessert-inspired flavors with nostalgic charm have been very popular recently. 25%, one in four of those in the survey say that they can tell immediately by the first taste if the coffee isn't right, if there's just something off about the coffee. So it's... here's hoping that you have good coffee this morning to start off your day. Forget the coffee. I thought this was kind of interesting. The three finalists for Burger King's $1 million Whopper contest have been announced. They're creating your own specialty Whopper sandwich. And the three finalists will actually have their creations served at Burger King restaurants very soon. It says the three Whoppers will be available at participating locations nationwide later this fall. They are the Fried Pickle Ranch Whopper, the Maple Bourbon Barbecue Whopper, and the Mexican Street Corn Whopper. More information on how to vote for the winner in the $1 million Whopper contest. More information on how to vote for the winner will be released in mid-November. So there you go. Big, big news to start off with this morning. What else is going on? Among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. This is good news. Opioid deaths have dropped to the lowest level in 3 years, it says here. These are provisional numbers from the CDC, that there were just over 75,000 opioid overdose deaths for the year ending in April. So from April of last year to April of this year, just over 75,000 overdose deaths, which is 75,000 too many, but the deaths have been trending down for the past several years, now at their lowest level in 3 years. And OD deaths have also been trending down in other groups of drugs, not just opioids, but cocaine and other stimulants, that kind of thing. There are some states that are still reporting overdoses nearly as high or even higher than previous records, including Wyoming, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Alaska. But you'll note that Ohio is not on that list. And not all that many years ago, Ohio was right at the top or near the top, like number one, number two for opioid deaths in the nation. So the fact that we're not on that list now is certainly good news. I wanted to share that. I saw on the Newswire this morning. Speaking of good news, here is good news. Most voters in a new ABC News Ipsos survey, most voters say that Taylor Swift's endorsement of Vice President Kamala Harris has no impact on how they will vote. That is such good news. I actually was worried about this. I mean, I laugh about it, I chuckle about it, but I was actually a little worried about this, that we were getting our voting advice from Taylor Swift, of all people. But 6%, just 6% of respondents said that they were more likely to vote for Kamala Harris based on Taylor Swift's endorsement. Just 6%. 13% actually said that they are less likely to vote for Kamala Harris because of Taylor Swift's endorsement. So to the extent that it was beneficial or harmful, it was actually, to the extent that people are paying attention, it may have actually done more harm than good, is what I mean to say. Meanwhile, 81% in the poll say the superstar's endorsement had absolutely no influence on how they would vote. So there we go. And we did report the other day that after Taylor Swift issued her endorsement, that they did register something like 500,000, 750,000 people registered to vote after she made her endorsement. But again, based on this survey, I wonder how many are actually went out and registered to vote so they could vote for Kamala Harris. How many actually registered to vote so they could specifically go out and vote against Taylor Swift's recommendation? You know what I mean? I think there is probably a fair number. And a couple of other items here among the first things that you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. No credible threat found following a bomb threat sent to the Ohio State House. Was sent into lockdown yesterday. The threat was sent via email on Monday morning. It was received. And so the State House was on lockdown yesterday because of a bomb threat. Officials say troopers and canines swept both the inside and outside of the building and did not find any credible threat. The incident remains under investigation. Is this what we have come to in this country? Can we just stop, please? Can we just stop all of this madness, all of this nonsense? Bomb threat at the State House. I don't know what this is all about, whether this is more of the nonsense coming out of Springfield and all of that. There are more bomb threats there and more events that have been canceled and all of that. But it's just getting out of hand. We need to stop. Everybody take a collective deep breath and sort of remember that we are human beings, and this is not how we are supposed to behave. This is not how we're supposed to behave. Oh, my goodness. And how about this to finish up? Lastly, this morning, among the first things you need to know, and this has nothing to do with politics or anything like that, it's just kind of cool. The full moon tonight. I don't know if you noticed the moon last night. I saw the moon last night. It was just big and beautiful and not a cloud in the sky. It was just beautiful last night. And the full moon tonight will be accompanied by a partial lunar eclipse. Yes, that's right. Another eclipse. We had an eclipse at the beginning of the year, and now we've got a solar eclipse at the beginning of the year. We've got a partial lunar eclipse here at the end of the year. And people in North and South America, Africa, and Europe will all have an opportunity to see some of the moon's exterior concealed by the shadow of the Earth. It says here the full moon today, this evening, is also the harvest moon, connected with harvest time in North America, according to NASA, will be emphasized because it is a supermoon. So it is closer, I guess. Is that what that means? A supermoon is closer to Earth than it normally is, appears bigger in the sky. In any event, the partial lunar eclipse starts this evening at 8:41 p.m. when the moon will begin joining the Earth's shadow. The full effect will not be completely noticeable until 10:13 p.m. when the rim of the moon is covered, according to this statement from NASA. About 8% of the moon's exterior will be in full shadow at 10:44 p.m. And, of course, you can watch a lunar eclipse without any specialty eyewear because it doesn't hurt your eyes to look at the moon. So, unlike the solar eclipse, it'll be a lot easier to watch. But, unlike the solar eclipse, it's only going to be a partial eclipse. But if you are interested, it is still kind of cool nonetheless. There you go, some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather, partly sunny today with a high around 80, partly cloudy tonight, a low around 60. Findlay City Schools says its Safe Defend active shooter protection system was accidentally activated at Wilson Vance Intermediate on Monday morning. The school district says the system was accidentally activated by a new employee before the school day began and that there was no emergency situation. The school district says first responders acted quickly and it continues to be grateful that the system effectively connects their entire safety network. Learn more about the Findlay City Schools Safe Defend system in the story on our website. This is National Roundabouts Week, and the Ohio Department of Transportation is touting the effectiveness of roundabouts, which it says have dramatically improved the safety of intersections throughout the country.
They improve intersection safety and improve congestion. They can handle a lot of traffic efficiently and do so while reducing crash severity and crash numbers.
That's ODOT's Sherry Newton during our conversation with her about the new roundabout that's under construction currently near US 68 and State Route 15 on the south side of Findlay. Get more from ODOT on the effectiveness and safety of roundabouts compared to traditional intersections in the story on our website. In Portage County, east of Akron, a local sheriff is facing questions about something he posted on social media.
Sheriff Bruce Sikowski appears to call on people to record the addresses of residents who publicly support presidential candidate Kamala Harris. The sheriff implies if Harris wins the election, he believes illegal migrants should live with those supporters. 3 News reached out to the sheriff's office for comment but did not receive a response back.
ONN's Dave Chudowski reporting. An upcoming event in Findlay is designed to connect foster families with resources. The United Way of Hancock County says the event, Open Hearts, Open Home, will be held on Saturday, October 12th at the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts and will bridge prospective foster families with essential resources and advocates to help them get started on their journey to foster care. Get more details in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Make this our cover story this morning. The folks from Mission Possible are with us in the studio. They are a local Christian outreach organization with a great deal of experience in working with the people of Haiti. And we've asked them to join us to sort of give a human perspective, put the human face on this issue that we've been talking about for much of the past week or so, the kind of thing that often gets lost in the political rhetoric. And Trace Roth and Renee Gabriel are here from Mission Possible. Trace, I want to start with you. First of all, help us understand when we talk about the Haitian immigrants that are coming here. And that is much of the work that you do in Haiti, other places too, but much of the work that you do is in Haiti. What is it that they are fleeing? What are they trying to escape from?
Well, particularly over the last 3 years with the government collapse, there's really a minimal government operating right now. Mm-hmm. And so within the country, there's a lot of gang control. And so the people are living under gang rule, basically. No law and order other than what the gang wants to do a particular day. Mm-hmm. And so there's just great uncertainty for safety. Can I get food? Can I move about freely? That's what they live under every day. And so that's the tension that the people of Haiti are in today.
Because I think sometimes, again, with the political rhetoric, we are led to believe that people who are coming into this country are coming here for the free handouts and, mm-hmm. you know, for mm-hmm. a, for mm-hmm. an easy ride. And, mm-hmm. and we don't understand the abject poverty and exactly. the real danger that actually exists in that country.
Yes, it's an everyday danger. You know, as I was thinking this morning, you know, my family, we got up, got ready, we're going to school, going to work. I don't have to worry about my kids' safety, where they're going. Mm-hmm. But the Haitian families, the people that we know, our friends and our staff, they wake up and wonder, can my kids go to school today safely?
Yeah.
Can I even travel to the market to buy food today? There's just that uncertainty every day. And even within the day, there's that tension of safety always.
And so you've got these individuals who are looking to find a better life, a fresh start, a new future for their families, themselves and their families. And what is the reaction? So you get here and you hear the kind of rhetoric that we are hearing this week in particular. And Renee, I know you posted a very heartfelt reaction on social media a few days ago about the reaction that you have and that those that you work with have to what this narrative is suddenly now here.
Mm-hmm. So I think what was eye-opening to me was at our ESL class, these are people that we have worked with for a year now, mm-hmm. and they had to make a point to tell me, I'm not here to hurt anyone. I'm not here to eat anyone's pets. Mm-hmm. And I think what people don't understand going off of the violence thing is they are fleeing the violence.
Yeah.
If they had the choice and if their country was safe, they would stay there. But they're not bringing the violence with them. They are fleeing the violence.
But see, this is another thing. And again, it becomes part of the political narrative. How do we know that the people who are coming here aren't the gang members themselves?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I would say the people that we interact with mm-hmm. are those who are wanting a better life.
Yeah,
they're coming here with no agenda other than I want safety for my family.
Yeah.
I want to find good work so that I could maybe support my family that's still in Haiti. So it's they're trying to raise themselves up and not come in under the guise of, ooh, what can I get or can I control in another place like I've been controlling in Haiti?
That being said, when they get here, what they find is almost certainly an improvement, but it is still not anything close to what we would consider, those streets of gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are living in a motel, you
right.
know, 3-4 room and people in a motel room. Mm-hmm. And so that's not ideal by any means to mm-hmm. come and do that. And so they're working long hours and they're working jobs that a lot of us don't want to do. And they're trying to learn English and provide for their families while they're here. But yeah, it's not ideal by any means.
Yeah,
just because they're in America.
And imagine what it would be like to say, for the safety of my family, I'm going to a foreign country. Mm-hmm. I don't know the language. Yeah. I'm unfamiliar with the culture. I'm pretty sure I can get a job. But I'm desperate enough to do those things for the safety of my family.
Yeah.
And when I get here, how do I improve my life at that point?
You mentioned the cultural differences. There is that desire to assimilate, right?
Yeah, I think for many of them, they know that if they want to be here and they want to succeed, find success, they've got to, you know, learn to assimilate a little bit. And that's mm-hmm. not easy. It's easy for them to stay in their little community at the motel. But mm-hmm. there are a good chunk of them who want to assimilate to our community.
And and to the extent that they kind of congregate within that own community unto themselves, is that out of necessity? I mean, I guess.
Well, I think there's a certain level of trauma that comes with the Haitian people as well. You know, they've experienced earthquakes, they've experienced gang issues. And so I think there is a sense of safety to stay with their own people mm-hmm. And not walk freely around because that's not something that they could freely do in their own country. So I think there is a sense of.
So even that is an assimilation.
Yeah. Yeah. These are my people. I know what they're saying to me. I know that they understand me. We've all been through something together. Mm-hmm. There is that sense of safety and security to stay together.
Kind of the strength in numbers sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it does raise, and again, we try and avoid all of the political rhetoric, but it does raise the question, and Trace, as you were talking about the conditions in Haiti, just by that nature, we'd like to take them all in. We, you know, just empty the country, bring them all here. We can't really do that. Right. So, you know, how do you make that determination of where you draw that line with how many that you can accommodate?
That's a great question, and I think those are the issues that we need to deal with our within our government and our systems, and what can we support and what can we do for other people. We can't do everything for everybody. So at what level we need to determine that within our society and within our government systems to do that.
And not just in Haiti. I know you are also involved in like the Dominican Republic and other places where conditions are similar.
Exactly. Yeah. And around the world, there are terrible situations where people are living. And what we can do as Americans is only to a certain level. So what do we do as a world community for people in these situations?
I want to mention real quickly, because that is part of what Mission Possible does with respect to trying to strengthen and build up those communities in Haiti and in the Dominican Republic and in those other countries as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's our baseline, is equipping a new generation of Christ-centered leaders. And our main goal is to introduce people to Christ, because that's where the heart changes, and it changes the total being and the person. Once we are able to do that, and once a person makes that achievement, and even with those who don't, we want to equip so that they can better themselves where they are. The tension is with open opportunities in other countries. People with means are leaving these areas, not only in Haiti, but other places. And so you've got the brain drain that goes away. Mm. And so our intent is to do what we can within the country to improve the communities where we've been placed, to make a difference there, because that's, like Renee was saying, that's their home, that's their culture, that's what they know and want to stay with.
I think anybody would say, if I had my druthers, this is where I would stay, but sometimes situations make that impossible. But that ultimately, that's the political conversation that we should be having.
Exactly.
How much do we are we able to bring people here, and how much are we able to help build up those countries?
Right, because we as an organization ask that same question: how much do we do? How much can we do safely and well financially? We have to answer those same questions here in America.
And in the meantime, a little compassion goes a long way, is the message.
Yeah.
And I think, again, I referenced the post that I saw on social media that you put, that was really kind of the message.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these are husbands and wives and brothers and their fathers and mothers, they're here. And so we can understand that feeling of, you want the best for your kids, you want the best for your family. And so to show just a little bit of compassion to them, I think they're brave for coming over into a country that they don't know of, and just trying to do what they can to make a better life for their families. And so you have to, we're not going to get better as humanity if we can't just love each other a little bit, you know?
Yeah. It's a good place to leave it. And again, the conversation will continue, but hopefully, you know, some things to kind of put in people's brains here this morning. Again, Renee Gabriel and Trace Roth with Mission Possible. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
You know, school meals are one of the most important sources of food for millions of students, particularly those from low-income families for whom school meals may be their primary source of nutrition. The USDA recently updated national nutrition standards to help put even healthier meals on school menus, but the latest federal spending bill included provisions that would weaken those standards, and this has groups such as the American Heart Association concerned. And joining us is CEO Nancy Brown. Nancy, tell us more about the updated school meal standards, first of all, and the impact that they would have, the way these stronger nutrition standards help ensure the success of children and students.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for having me. And the USDA's stronger nutrition standards for school meals are great news for American families. They will help children get the proper nutrition to help them succeed in the classroom and have a healthy future. For the first time, the amount of added sugars in school meals will be capped, which is a major stride for children's health. We know that added sugars are a source of excess calories, provide no nutritional value, may cause weight gain, and can increase the risk for serious health conditions. The new standards also mean school meals will contain less sodium and continue to emphasize whole grains and include a variety of fruits and vegetables.
Obviously, school lunches are only as nutritious insofar as they are appealing to students. They can be the best meals on the planet nutritionally, but it doesn't matter if kids don't want to eat them. Now, I know that this is the question you hear all the time, and it is the easy argument, but what is the response to those who say that we would be wasting money by trying to implement standards that are too stringent?
Well, you know, research shows absolutely the opposite of that. We know that having healthier food in schools for the more than 30 million children each year that eat school meals can increase participation in school meal programs. We know that giving children, for example, adequate time to eat can be an important way to make sure that kids are eating these healthier foods. Then for those of us who enjoy cooking, you know, there are many ways to make popular foods for kids in a healthier way, you know, with more whole grains, less sodium, mm-hmm. as an example, less sugar. You know, it just like for us adults, you know, there are ways to make food appealing and still reduce these harmful ingredients to the health of our children.
Now, as we mentioned, the USDA can set the standards, but it's Congress who controls the purse strings. And in the latest federal spending bill, there are provisions that you are concerned would weaken those standards that the USDA has set forth. How do we ensure that kids have access to those healthy school meals, that they that the standards are protected and that everyone has access to them?
Well, of course, at the American Heart Association, we are urging Congress to protect and strengthen these nutrition standards and support school food programs so that children receive the healthiest meals possible. Lawmakers shouldn't play politics with the health of our children, and they must oppose any effort to weaken school meal standards. And your listeners can help us. You know, we really urge all of your listeners to help us focus on the health of our children and the healthful nature of food in our schools. And we urge you to join the American Heart Association in telling your members of Congress to protect children's health and keep school meals nutritious. And you can do that by texting LUNCH at 46839.
Does the American Heart Association support the idea of universal free school lunches?
Well, we absolutely believe that all children deserve the right to have healthful food in their lives. And we know that schools are an important place for children to get a healthy meal. We know that providing all kids healthy school meals at no cost is proven to increase school meal participation, to improve diets, and to reduce the stigma of eating school meals. And so the American Heart Association very much believes that these school food programs make a difference in what children consume overall.
I know a lot of, obviously during the pandemic, that was widely embraced. And since then, a number of school districts and even states have continued to embrace that. But I'm wondering if that specifically is part of this advocacy with respect to strengthening these standards and making these more nutritional meals available to all students.
American Heart Association, of course, focuses on nutrition security as a major priority of our work. We have many programs and advocacy efforts to make sure that we are not leaving people behind when it comes to having access to healthful food. This particular USDA action is about the school nutritious standards, but if kids don't have access to healthy food,
right,
and we aren't doing some, society to make sure that people everywhere are not food insecure, you know, then we're not doing our job. So it's a two-part deal, if you will. You know, this particular action is on the USDA standards, but it lives within the context of the American Heart Association's longstanding priority to focus on nutrition and food insecurity for children and adults everywhere.
Again, Nancy Brown is CEO of the American Heart Association with us this morning in support of these strengthened USDA school nutrition standards, school meal standards. You mentioned the website where folks can learn more about your advocacy for this. Mention that again.
Yes, our website is heart.org. And we encourage your listeners to join the American Heart Association in telling your members of Congress to protect children's health by keeping school meals nutritious by texting lunch at 46839.
Nancy Brown, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
Once again, I have my Joe Cocker voice on here this morning. You are so beautiful to me. Can't you see? I just say a little touch of laryngitis here, but we're powering through this morning. And
we interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
I do. I feel like Joe Cocker, Bonnie Tyler, or something like that. In the broken news of this morning, let's see here. We begin in Georgia. Where a man was issued a speeding ticket doing 90 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour zone. That's really, you know, that's really booking it. But this speeding ticket was, I mean, you know, 90 in a 55 is pretty excessive, but still $1.4 million was the fine. Connor Cato, said the amount, when he learned the amount of his ticket, the amount of the fine, just stunned him. I knew it was going to be a pretty hefty fine for that rate of speed, but $1.4 million was beyond comprehension, he said. When he called the court in Savannah, Georgia, to find out if maybe there was an error, he was initially told, nope, there's no mistake, it's $1.4 million. But later, the representative from the court admitted that the amount was not actually, it was just kind of a placeholder. You know, when they create the template for the speeding ticket fine, they have to put some amount in there, and somebody just as a joke put $1.4 million and that the fine actually would be somewhere around $1,000. So still a pretty hefty fine. 90 and a 55 is going to carry a pretty stiff fine, but $1,000, you know, I think that's what they really should do, because if you were to tell someone that they were going to get a $1,000 fine for speeding, they'd be like, what do you mean $1,000? That's crazy. But if you first tell them it's $1.4 million and then tell them it's $1,000, it's a lot more palatable. Yeah. So maybe it was all psychological to begin with. I don't know. Let's see here. Elsewhere in the broken news, speaking of traffic violations and such things, apparently in Colorado Springs, a possible drunk driver is to blame for hitting an ambulance. Officers heard the crash early Saturday morning, rushed over to see a car had rear-ended a parked ambulance. One passenger was taken to the hospital with serious injuries, probably not in that ambulance, but the man behind the wheel was also hurt and arrested for DUI and other charges. That's, you know, you're in trouble. You strike an ambulance, rear in an ambulance. Not to be outdone, talk about there's drunk, and then there's this guy in California who crashed his car into a fire hydrant. Not only that, the driver was apparently so inebriated that he proceeded to continue driving down the road with the fire hydrant stuck under his car. What a way to call attention to yourself. You know, that's you're driving down the highway with a fire hydrant underneath your car, you're probably going to attract the attention of police. He is was placed under arrest as well. Sometimes you don't have to go very far to find the broken news. This from Bedford, Ohio, where an 8-year-old went missing on Sunday morning, only to be found later at a Target store 25 minutes away from her home. Officers say they got a call from the girl's family reporting that the 8-year-old was last seen around 7 a.m., but had gone missing along with the family's Nissan Rogue. The vehicle was missing from the driveway. You can see where this is going, right? According to local news reporters, footage from a neighbor's doorbell camera showed the little girl, 8 years old, getting into the vehicle and driving away. Traffic cameras later spotted the SUV on a local road before catching up with the vehicle, minus the girl, in a Target parking lot. She was later found inside the store. She took the family car and went to Target. No one was hurt during the Target run, but the girl did tell police that she accidentally struck a mailbox along the way. At least she owned up to it. That's crazy. 8 years old. And took the family car, just went for a trip to Target. Just needed a few things. Just needed a quick run to the store. Yeah. Wow, 8 years old. Let's see. Now, this is weird, and you know it had to come from Florida. I'm not sure exactly where in Florida. Chelsea White has been arrested for a second time for battery involving an adult toy. A second time for battery. Ms. White allegedly threw the toy at her boyfriend and left the couple's home. Apparently, Ms. White was arrested over a similar incident 2 years ago when the pair got into another altercation involving the same or a similar adult toy. It is unclear if both fights involved the same toy. Ms. White has been ordered to complete an intervention program. Can you imagine sharing in that intervention program? What landed you there? Yeah. Okay, and finally, in the broken news this morning, the story of 27-year-old Nebraska man Zachary Scheich. Scheich? I think is how you pronounce it. Zachary Scheich. He was sentenced to up to 120 years in prison for pretending to be a 17-year-old and enrolling in a local high school. Apparently, he used this ruse to meet underage girls. It was Lincoln Northwest High School and Lincoln Southeast High School. He apparently tried to pull this off twice. Mr. Scheich was apparently able to blend in to the student population because he is, even though he's 27 years old, he's only 5'4", so he's very small in stature. And so he blended right in. A district official said that Mr. Scheich procured a fake birth certificate and academic transcript. He will be eligible for parole in 40 years. That is, wow, that is crazy. To meet underage girls. Man, scary. There you go. That is today's broken news, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines, and it certainly is that this morning. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
Parents, now's the time to give your kids a lesson in school bus and pedestrian safety. Teach your children these tips to keep them safe. When getting off a bus, look both ways before crossing. Before crossing the street, take 5 giant steps out from the front of the bus, make eye contact with the driver, and wait for the driver to signal it's safe to cross. And tell kids to stand back from the road when waiting for the bus. This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Today is Constitution Day, which commemorates the adoption, the signing of the U.S. Constitution on this day in 1787. It is also known as Citizenship Day. As a matter of fact, it was actually back in the 1950s, they officially changed the name of Constitution Day to Citizenship Day. But be that as it may, whatever we call it, the Annenberg Public Policy Center has now released their annual Constitution Day Civics Survey, which reveals that many Americans have some brushing up to do about our Constitution. For example, just 65% of those in the survey could correctly name all three branches of government. Those would be, of course, executive, legislative, and judicial. Only 65% of Americans can actually identify those three separate but equal branches of government. 74% of those polled know that the First Amendment protects freedom of speech. However, there are four other rights outlined by the First Amendment, the foundational tenet of the American government. Just 39% could name the freedom of religion. 29% freedom of the press. 11% knew that the First Amendment guarantees the right to petition the government for a redress of grievances. And 27% protecting the right to assembly. So those are the other rights there. Freedom of speech is the easy one, but the other ones that are included in that amendment are not so easily recognized. What's more, only a little over half of those in the survey knew that Republicans are currently in control of the House and Democrats in control of the Senate, which hardly seems possible in an election year, but that's what they say. 86% do know that Supreme Court justices are appointed, not elected, and 85% know that they serve life terms, their lifetime appointments. But just 56% said that they know that the Supreme Court has the final say as to what is constitutional and what isn't in the law. Most of those 56% believe that ability rested with the White House. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center, in a media release says civics knowledge matters. Those who do not understand the rights protected by the Constitution can neither cherish nor invoke them. And those who do not know which party controls the House and Senate may misattribute credit or blame for action or inaction. Those rights that are not protected are lost. Those that are not recognized and cherished and invoked and used will eventually be lost. This is serious stuff here. And there are some serious shortcomings in the knowledge of some people, and by the survey, it seems a great many people, as to what the Constitution actually says. So maybe dust that off and give it a quick read. If nothing else, good to read those first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, just to refresh yourself on this Constitution Day. The newly formed Great Lakes Guardianship Services Board is starting to take shape. We reported on this in the news last week. It is a new agency that is dedicated to helping adults with specific special needs, special circumstances, special considerations navigate the legal system. And Director Cheryl Miller is with us in the studio this morning. And Cheryl, the description of what the Great Lakes Guardianship Services Board does sounds very familiar to people who maybe have heard of the CASA program before.
Yes, yes. Thank you for having me this morning. Yes, so when you look at the CASA program, it's a special advocacy program for children mm-hmm. within the court system. And this is a very similar program for individuals who are determined to be incompetent. And that's a very specific legal term that's defined and has to be adjudicated by a judge.
What are, and because that is, when we hear the word incompetent, we may have, conjure up a specific image, but legally, as you say, there is a specific definition. What would that entail?
Usually it entails at least some evaluation by a professional, whether it be a psychiatrist or a medical doctor. And that's a definition where an individual is determined to not be able to make safe and sound decisions for themselves, whether it be their person or their estate. And so there are concerns regarding the safety of that individual within the community.
So it may have to do with a mental health evaluation. It may be an addiction, things of that nature.
Yes, as well as a developmental disability.
Okay. Your job then, the job of the guardian would be, again, not unlike the CASA program, to speak for that individual, not in a legal sense. You're not talking about attorneys, an attorney relationship. This would be a different type of relationship.
Right. So as a guardian, that individual, or in this case, our board, would then provide guardianship services to that individual. Again, not a legal capacity, would not be able to represent them in court, but would be able to, pay their bills, make sure that they're getting the treatment that they need to be healthy and successful.
So is this something that you need individuals to serve in those roles? Or how will that work?
Unlike CASA, no. So in the probate court world, when you are seeking a guardian,
allergies. I know, we both have this going on here this morning.
When you're seeking a guardian, there's a couple different ways the court will find a guardian. It can be an attorney. It could be a family member. Well, in Ohio, in the last 20, 25 years, we've really struggled to find enough guardians. So the Guardianship Service Board is actually an entity where we hire the staff who are the guardians. So the guardian would be the board, and then the staff would carry out the guardianship services.
So these individuals would be actually on staff, not volunteers.
Correct.
And one of the things that's worth pointing out is that, this is not the Hancock County Guardianship Services Board. This is the Great Lakes Guardianship Services Board. So you actually encompass a number of counties here in Northwest Ohio.
Yes. The board is overseen by three counties. So it would be Hancock, Wood, and Ottawa. So Judge Johnson here in Hancock, and then Judge Westner in Wood County, and Judge Haney in Ottawa County came together and formed this board so that those services could occur in their counties.
How, and as we said, this is just now taking shape. You are have just been hired as the director to kind of oversee this and putting this together, launching this program. How long will this take to get up and running?
We've already started. It's going to take phases. Right. Mm-hmm. Like any agency, we've started taking our first cases. And in Ohio, guardianship service boards are relatively new. It's a new law. It's a new approach. So we're kind of in uncharted waters. We don't really know. We have an idea what to expect, but we're not really sure. So there's a lot of flexibility within the structure of the board so that we can meet the needs of the individuals where they're at. as well as seeking technical assistance from other guardianship boards within the state of Ohio.
It's interesting you mentioned that this is not just new to our area. It is relatively new to the state of Ohio. Again, referencing how similar this is to the CASA program, is that what kind of inspired this to say, hey, you know, maybe, you know, this has been successful with respect to, you know, helping children navigate the legal system. There are certain adults who could benefit from similar services?
Yeah. It's kind of a grassroots, homegrown effort. It started basically out of Columbus. Like I said, the last 20 years, we knew as professionals this was coming. We just didn't have enough capacity in the court system to meet the needs of all those wards that have been identified. So, there was a lot of probate judges that sat around and really thought, well, how can we fix this and make a solution?
How great is the need for this to help us understand just why this is so significant?
The need keeps growing. And the reason why is, I'm sure, you know, the regular population understand that we don't have as many people as we used to. So traditionally in the probate world, when someone was, say, maybe born with a developmental disability, their parents would take care of them. Mm-hmm. And then when the parents passed, then the siblings would take care of them. Well, in today's world, that's not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. A lot of families maybe only have one or two children.
Right.
Children move across the country. Or, you know, individuals have really small families where maybe, you know, caregivers pass away. Mm-hmm. So the need has been growing exponentially over the years. And so this is just one attempt to try to meet that need without stressing the legal system.
So is this something that a family, an individual or a family can request a guardian to assist their loved one or family member that they maybe are not able to? As you mentioned, you know, families today are all spread out. I can envision someone, say, in Montana saying, you know, right, my brother has this issue and needs some help, but I'm not in a position to do that. Is that how this works? Or
For this board, absolutely. My information, my contact information is available. And I would love families to call me and we can walk through the process. Again, I'm not an attorney. I can't provide legal advice, mm-hmm, but I can explain the process and what those definitions look like and how one would go about it. A lot of families are, facing that crossroads and not sure what to do.
Right. And is this strictly, as you mentioned, this is actually formed through the probate court. So is this specifically limited to probate cases, or is it involving other cases as well?
Many of the individuals that we're serving, they initiate the competency evaluation out of probate court. Probate court has the jurisdiction over that type of legal definition. Mm-hmm. But many of the individuals that I'm serving have other cases in other courts. So there's a lot of, judicial collaboration that has to occur.
A lot of crossover there.
Yeah.
So again, this is something that is just now taking shape. And it, like you said, it is not necessarily a volunteer position. However, is this something that you are going to need individuals to serve on the board, as community service kind of thing?
The board is comprised of 9 members, 3 from each community.
Okay.
And they're appointed by their respective probate judges.
Gotcha.
And they serve 4-year terms. So we do have a full board right now. God love them. They're helping me navigate every day. especially Hancock County Probate Court Judge Johnson is my administrative judge. So we're really trying to, you know, step through some challenging situations and trying to figure out the best way to approach. But as on the board side, eventually we will be hiring additional staff. We realize there's a caseload, you know, kind of like any other case manager. And then as we grow, we'll add staff to meet those needs.
Got to be exciting to kind of get in on the ground level of something that really can make such a significant difference in the community.
I'm terribly excited and humbled. This is a brand new adventure in Ohio. And so it's just really an honor to be a part of something that would be, you know, long after me.
Yeah. We've got a link on our webpage for more information. I know the Great Lakes Guardianship Services Board has a Facebook page on social media to kind of update on. There's not a whole lot there because it's brand new, but I would imagine as this grows and develops and works through this process, there'll be more information. So if you want to check it out, we've got it linked up at our webpage at goodmornings.net. And again, Director Cheryl Miller, thanks very much for dropping by. We appreciate it. And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. And remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Go to goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, hopefully, I'll finally have my voice back. And the expectation is that the Federal Reserve is about to cut interest rates for the first time in more than 4 years. But will it really make any difference for consumers? We'll take a look at a new CNET Money survey. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.